Here it is!
From deep inside your radio,
meet Harry the Swinger.
Thank you very much, the late Ernie Anderson. And from, once again, from London, England, and ladies and gentlemen, I'm duty-bound to report that despite the best efforts of health and safety people over here, I actually have adequate level in my headphones this week. I don't know what happened, but it's going to be our little secret. So, yes, London, England, one more time, came for the riots, stayed for the food. And if you're wondering about this place and the culture thereof, or what distinguishes England from the United States, it really boils down to the names of health and beauty aids, the brand names of health and beauty aids that you can purchase at your local store, or as they say here, shop. So, for example, Rogaine is Regain. Swear to, I'm not making this up. Rogaine in America is Regain. Here, same product. Anacin is Anadin. You see what I'm saying? And oil of Olay in the United Kingdom is oil of Olay, or at least it was until a few years ago. So it's two countries separated by a single vowel in the names of health and beauty aids. Keep that in mind, and you'll understand all of the rest. Because Olay, you know, that makes more sense, doesn't it, really, when you stop to think about it? Ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. 2 years after the clergy sex abuse scandal first exploded, according to this newspaper, in the United States, lawsuits have been settled, reports issued, blah, blah, blah. Although the vast majority of the accused priests were removed from ministry long ago, church officials say they have no way to monitor where the men are now. So if you see a formerly abusive priest in your neighborhood, give a holler, won't you? Nor do they keep official data on how many were defrocked or stripped of their priestly status, how many were imprisoned or placed on sex offender lists, how many are working, and how many are dead, don't you know? The priests have largely vanished from public view. Their fates are often a mystery to their victims, their parishioners, and even their attorneys. Independently compiling data about what happened to the men is nearly impossible. Reports by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops show that at least 5,768 priests were accused from 1950 to 2009. That's just 5,700 priests. What's the big deal? Although the church deems most of the allegations credible, the vast majority have never been proved. Many of the priests have never been publicly identified. A comprehensive list of names does not exist. By the way, apropos, although on a totally different subject, there is no list, there is no authoritative list of the names and the locations of the 100,000 people who were evacuated from New Orleans by a bus, train, helicopter to points unknown to them at the time, given a one-way ticket and said and told, see ya. No comprehensive list of those people and how they're doing, or whether they'd like to come back. And the Roman Catholic Church, battered by sexual abuse scandals, back to news of the godly. Scandals, I say, from the United States to Belgium, is facing a new set of damaging allegations in the Netherlands. Figures released this week by an investigative commission showed that almost 2,000 people had made complaints of sexual or physical abuse against the church in a country with only 4 million Catholics. So somebody's busy. The Roman Catholic Church has not faced a crisis like this since the French Revolution, says a professor of the history of religion in the Netherlands. One legal case starts this week. Accusations against two former bishops. The reaction of the church appears to have fueled the crisis. Nearly all of the cases are decades old. Asked in March on television about the hundreds of complaints already surfacing, one of the church's most senior figures, Cardinal Adriano Simonis, shocked the nation by replying not in Dutch, but in the beloved German, Wir haben es nicht gewusst. We knew nothing, he said, using a phrase associated with Nazi excuses after World War II. A lot of people, said the professor, Peter Neeson, a professor of the history of religion, a lot of people perceived it as an affirmation of the culture of covering up cases, adding that it meant to many we should have known, or we knew, but we didn't want to know. But it was in German. A warning in and out. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen, the copyrighted feature of Hello, Welcome to the Show.
I am not such a clever one about the latest fad. I admit I was never one adored by local lads. Not that I ever try to be a saint. I'm the type that they classify as quaint. I'm old-fashioned. I love the moonlight. I love the old-fashioned things. The sound of rain upon starry song that April sings. This year's fancies are passing fancies, but sighing sighs, holding hands, ease my heart. But I don't mind it. That's how I want to be. As long as you agree to stay old-fashioned with me.
From Leicester Square in London, England. You've heard of it. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And you know what that means. News of the Olympic movement. The London Olympics will be officially conducted in French, with English as its second language, according to previously secret contracts seen by the newspaper The Daily Telegraph. As the first tongue of the International Olympic Committee, French must take precedence at medal giving and all other Olympic ceremonies. Billboards and pageantry in French, as well as English, must be displayed throughout London. The stipulation is among thousands of pages of detailed demands made by the IOC as a condition of hosting the Games. Other legally binding requirements include providing at least 40,000 hotel rooms for International Olympic Committee members. That's just nice. Foreign sports administrators and other official guests. And producing the Queen for a ceremony planned by the IOC just before the games open, at which its members can all meet her. And that's just nice. The British flag must be flown fifth in precedence behind the Olympic flag, the London 2012 symbol, the United Nations flag, and the flag of Greece, in honor of the first European Union country to go bankrupt. A recommended 700 people connected to the Olympic Committee must be given a dedicated car and chauffeur, and 400 more must have a pool car and driver. London must, quote, require behavior modification for residents, public and business communities, unquote, because transportation will be disrupted. So, modify your behavior accordingly. Like, stay home or leave. The documents of the so-called Olympic Technical Manuals described by the IOC as an integral part of the host city contract signed by London when it won the Games. They were obtained under Freedom of Information laws. After a two-year battle, as well as saying that the Olympic ceremonies must be presented in English and French and that the English version should be read after the French, they demand draconian powers to protect sponsors such as Coke and McDonald's from, quote, ambush marketing by rivals. London is required to prevent spectators from, quote, wearing clothes or accessories with commercial messages other than the manufacturer's brand name. This would ban them from wearing football clubs' jerseys, which usually carry the name of the club sponsor. Games organizers must attempt to confiscate any infringing ambush material from spectators, although there are warnings against being overzealous. The city authorities must also obtain control of all billboard advertising, city transportation advertising, airport advertising for the duration of the games and the month preceding. Olympic brand protection teams must confront violators and conduct surveillance across London. Police and customs officers must enforce sponsorship rules. Britain has complied by passing an act of parliament which makes ambush marketing at the games a criminal offense and gives officials power to enter homes and seize infringing material. The Olympics. It's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. En français, s'il vous plaît. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, too clean and safe and cheap to meter. Vermont Yankee, the troubled nuclear power plant in Vermont, hence the first half of its name, has notified the state health department last week about high concentrations of tritium detected in samples taken late November from two of its nine newest groundwater monitoring wells, deeper wells about 60 feet below ground level. The findings of tritium is a particular concern because one of the wells is near the former drinking water well. That well was found to be contaminated with tritium in October. This was the first finding of tritium contamination in a drinking water well on-site or off-site. So drink up, folks in Vermont. It's clean. It's clean. Deadline's Columbia, South Carolina, utility company provided false information and failed for months to fix important nuclear safety equipment at its Darlington County nuclear power plant last year, according to federal regulators. Progress Energy, Carolinas. What's wrong with Progress Energy? It's Progress. They face increased federal oversight as a result of the problem cited by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Company officials said Progress did not try to mislead federal regulators, and company workers attempted to fix problems discovered in a generator a couple years ago. The problems have now been resolved. But missteps cited by the commission put Progress on a short list for federal action if the company suffers more troubles. For now, the NRC won't fine Progress, but the agency may increase inspections. Man, this is a draconian regime they're running. No fine. We may increase inspections because, you know, those would be bad. The NRC's findings come during a year when the plant has suffered two fires and an electrical fault in a pump motor at the coolant plant. NRC officials say the agency has given more scrutiny to the Darlington County nuclear plant this year than other South Carolina power stations. This week's notice centers on problems with an emergency generator that keeps the plant safe if a power outage occurs. Without the emergency power to cool atomic fuel, the plant could suffer a meltdown and leak radiation, federal officials said. So why fine them for screwing around with that? We may just increase inspections. We'll let you know. And Deadline Trenton, New Jersey electricity company Exelon, there you go, said this week it will close the nation's oldest nuclear power plant in 2019, 10 years earlier than planned. The Chicago-based company said changing markets and upkeep costs for Oyster Creek Nuclear Generating Station in the Forked River area have caused its value to decline. The company issued a statement confirming the shutdown plans. The plant went online in 1969 will not be required to build one or more cooling towers to replace its current technology, which draws 1.5 billion gallons of water a day from Barragat Bay, killing billions of aquatic creatures each year. So don't look for oysters near Oyster Creek. The plant is 60 miles east of Philadelphia, 75 miles south of New York City. It faces a unique set of economic conditions and changing environmental regulations that make ending operations in 2019 the best option for the company, employees, and shareholders. Exelon President Chris Crane said low market prices and demand and the plant's need for continuing large capital expenditures have reduced its value, unlike other, I guess, nuclear plants, because they're clean, cheap, safe. Too clean, cheap, safe to meter. It's nuclear power. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Well, this is going to be kind of a mini dump of some of the best stuff from WikiLeaks this week, as published by the British newspaper The Guardian, stuff you may not have read or heard about in the United States. Even here in Great Britain, the mainstream media, some of them at least, are a bit blasé about it. A columnist, for the Times of London this morning on television described what WikiLeaks had come up with so far as, well, you know, just telling you what a bear does in the woods. Now, of course, bears do a lot of different things in the woods. So here we go. Rampant government corruption in Afghanistan and the apparent powerlessness of the U.S. to do anything about it is laid bare by several classified diplomatic cables implicating members of the country's elite. In one astonishing incident in October 2009, then-Vice President Ahmad Zia Massoud was stopped and questioned in Dubai when he flew into Dubai with $52 million in cash, according to a diplomatic report. Massoud was detained by officials from the U.S. and the United Arab Emirates trying to stop money laundering, said the cable. However, the vice president was allowed to go on his way without explaining where the money came from. The cable sent by Ambassador Carl Eikenberry detailed the colossal scale of capital flight from Afghanistan, often with the cash simply carried out on flights from Kabul to the United Arab Emirates. Quote, vast amounts of cash come and go from the country on a weekly, monthly, and annual basis. Before the most recent election, $600 million in banking system withdrawals were reported. Couriers are usually said to carry the money on Pamir Airlines, which is jointly owned by Kabul Bank. That's convenient, and influential Afghans, such as Mahmoud Karzai, one of the president's brothers. The cable reports that exporting cash is encouraged by the fact that drug traffickers, corrupt officials, and to a large extent illicit business owners, do not benefit from keeping millions of dollars in Afghanistan and instead are motivated to move value into accounts and investments outside. Oh, there's more. The British government's deep fears that Libya would take harsh and immediate action against United Kingdom interests if the convicted Lockerbie bomber died in a Scottish prison are revealed in secret U.S. embassy cables showing London's full support for the early release of Abdel Bassett al-Megrahi. Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan leader, made explicit threats to halt all trade deals with Britain and harass embassy staff if Megrahi remained in jail, the cable said. At the same time, a parade of treats was offered by Libya to the Scottish administration if it agreed to let him go. The cable says they were turned down. The London chargé d'affaires wrote in a cable to Washington in October 2 years ago, the Libyans have told Her Majesty's government that flat out there will be enormous repercussions for the UK-Libya bilateral relationship if Megrahi's early release is not handled properly. So, you know, the cancer, the 3 months to live and the thing. Because he's still alive, by the way. Long 3 months. No, it's good. It's a lucky individual. But still, that was the pretext for the early release. Is he's got 3 months to live, and of course, he's still alive. Oh, I'm still here. And more. Saudi Arabia made important progress in aggressively trying to curtail the flow of funds to terrorist groups, but the oil-rich kingdom and its Gulf Arab neighbors still remain major sources of financing for militant movements like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, according to leaked U.S. government documents. They paint a stark picture of Washington's challenge in convincing key allies of the need to clamp down on terror funding, much of which is believed to stem from private donors in those nations. Saudi Arabia, ladies and gentlemen. Yet, there's good news from Saudi Arabia as well. Satellite broadcasts of Desperate Housewives and Late Show with David Letterman are doing more to persuade Saudi youth to reject violent jihad than hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. government propaganda, informants have told the American embassy.
Yeah. Hey, kids, don't do the jihad. Just swing.
Broadcasts uncensored and with Arabic subtitles alongside sitcoms such as Friends. The shows are being allowed as part of the kingdom's war of ideas against its extremist elements. According to a secret cable titled David Letterman, Agent of Influence, they've been proving more effective than Washington's main propaganda tool, the U.S.-funded Al-Hurra TV news channel. Al-Hurra has shown lengthy interviews with politicians like George W. Bush, but has run into problems with locally hired journalists. On one occasion, it broadcast a call to arms against Israel by Hezbollah, which was not the plan for the station's programming. A top strategist claimed U.S. leaked diplomatic cables prove the Australian government has not been honest with the Australian people about the war in Afghanistan. Professor Hugh White from the Australian National University said latest revelations from WikiLeaks expose some of the government's deep misgivings about the war in Afghanistan. They quote previous Prime Minister Kevin Rudd as saying Afghanistan, quote, scares the hell out of him. They also quote Special Envoy Rick Smith describing the situation in the war-ravaged country as, quote, a wobbly three-legged stool. That doesn't sound good. Those aren't good. Those aren't the best kind of stools.
Are they?
Oh, I'm over here. Despite the downbeat assessments of officials, the Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, insists that progress is being made, despite the fact Australia could be there for another 10 years. It always seemed to me the government was much gloomier in private than it was in public, Professor White says. More? Yes. Dateline Baghdad, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki fired dozens of officers from the security and intelligence services early this year and replaced them with inexperienced political officers loyal to his Shiite party, U.S. officials reported in February in cables leaked this week. The firings were carried out under the guise of purging members of Saddam Hussein's long-extinct Ba'ath Party. But U.S. officials in Baghdad fretted in cables that Maliki would do, quote, serious harm to the intelligence institutions by drumming out experienced and proficient officers, including many Sunni Arabs. The cables were published on the website of Al-Akbar, a Beirut daily. It wasn't immediately clear how Al-Akbar obtained these cables. They haven't been published as of last week by WikiLeaks. The firings were widely reported at the time. The cables portray a prime minister bent on increasing the influence of party loyalists inside some of Iraq's most powerful and secretive law enforcement agencies. Yeah, we knew all this, didn't we? See, the thing is, I think the people in Washington and New York and London official and semi-official capacities may indeed have known all this, and it may be bears in the woods to them, but not to us. Like this. The British Foreign Office was planning for the possibility that Britain might attack Iraq without UN approval more than 6 months before the invasion, according to a hitherto classified document written shortly before a meeting between Tony Blair and George Bush at Camp David. The document was drawn up by John Williams, not the Star Wars composer. His press advisor to the then Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, it spelled out ways to soften up the media, including critics like The Guardian. Under the heading, Not Taking the UN Route, Williams wrote, Our argument should be narrow and put with vigor. Iraq is uniquely dangerous. His memo, dated September 2002, when the government was still trying to get UN support for military action and when the Attorney General was advising that clear UN authority was needed, says the dossier presented by the British government at the time had no killer fact which proves that Saddam must be taken on now, or that weapons will be used against this, or that this or that weapon will be used against this. Williams wrote, "Our target is not the argumentative interviewer or opinionated columnist, but the kind of people to whom ministerial interviews are background hum on the car or kitchen radio." It's not condescending, is it? He added, "Listeners in traffic jams will understand that intelligence is partial, dangerous to acquire, and limited at what is safe to put out in public. If the dossier is judged by these rather than by newspaper standards, it will be worth doing." The humanitarian argument, he continued, needs to be made more noisily and consistently. The media strategy needs to, quote, fix one image of brutality in the public mind. It's just a strategy. And the Vatican refused to allow its officials to testify before an Irish commission investigating the clerical abuse of children and was angered when they were summoned from Rome. This according to a U.S. embassy cable through WikiLeaks. Just, you know, bears in the woods, babe. That's all it is. In reaction to all of this, you know, Hillary Clinton publicly apologized to the Afghan government for some of the less complimentary observations in some of the cable, State Department cables, made public by WikiLeaks, which basically grew out of a previously publicized cable by the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry. And at a meeting this week, the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, took so-called high road after being criticized in those leaks. Standing next to Karzai during a news conference, U.S. Defense Secretary Bob Gates said he was grateful that Karzai and other allies have responded to the WikiLeaks leaks, in his view, in an extraordinarily statesmanlike way. "I'm deeply grateful, and frankly, I think the American government will not forget this kind of statesmanlike response." Response to what? One American diplomatic memo divulged by WikiLeaks quotes a U.S. ambassador, Eikenberry, describing Karzai as paranoid and weak. Another says Karzai had freed dangerous detainees and drug dealers from prison because of their connections to influential Afghan figures. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, and on a related subject, this.
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where you give us the tote bag.
From the newly refurbished presidential palace in downtown Kabul, this is Karzai Talk. I'm Walid.
And I'm Hamid. We're Crunk and Junk, the carpet brothers.
I know why they call me Junk.
Yes, because you sell it.
Please, I'm in the puppy business, not the value-added business. Nah. But tell me again, why do they call you Crank?
Don't ask me, ask WikiLeaks. 1 week, I'm bipolar. The next week, I'm the opposite. Speaking of which, today's show is brought to you with the help of the good people at the United States Embassy, leakier than the men's room on the Titanic.
You know what? I've stopped reading what they say about me.
Oh, I stopped reading my reviews after Ambassador Eikenberry's critique of me went public 2 years ago.
Oh, that's right. He said you weren't a good partner. Mm-hmm. Which is true. I've tried playing bridge with my brother.
Oh, you're hopeless. Before the game was half over, you'd sold the cards.
What kind of berry is an Eikenberry anyway?
Doesn't grow here. That's all I know.
Nothing grows here. Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hello, Karzai Talk, guys. It's Hillary Clinton.
Oh. I hope she's not calling collect.
Even if she is, she's still paying for it.
I just wanted to apologize again for the leaks.
You sound like my brother before he went to the bladder doctor.
No, seriously. I just hope that we're able to continue our wonderful relationship despite all the comments that some of our people made about how crappy our relationship is.
Oh, were we at Karzai Talk World Headquarters? Just want you to know we are big fans of yours.
Oh, that's right. We've got all your records.
Seriously, guys, what can we do to help repair this relationship?
Well, it's like I always tell my younger brother.
Uh-oh, here we go. Another lesson from the feet of the master.
Not from the feet, straight from the lips. No, a government is like a car. Uh-huh. Without a lubricant, it stops running. In the case of a government, the lubricant is...
Let me guess. Money.
That's right. And, as with a car, even if it burns some lubricant from time to time, it can still get you where you want to go.
Even if the lubricant is supplied by U.S. taxpayers.
Sure. Who else? Iran?
No, I know, but just teasing out this metaphor a little. Mm. But isn't there any way to stop this car from burning so much lubricant?
Yes, but not while you're driving it. Thanks for the call.
Just one more reason why pantsuits are not part of Afghan culture. Hello, you're on Cars I Talk.
Hey, guys, Bob Gates here.
Hey.
I was just passing through town. Thought I'd give you a call.
Oh, our ratings may not be going up, but our demographics are sure shooting through the roof.
Mr. Secretary, thanks for calling.
Well, I just wanted to thank both of you, particularly Hamid, for being so mature this week.
Oh, my brother was mature?
Yes.
What'd you do, double down on your lithium?
No, it just was an awkward situation.
No, he's good at those. No.
and he could have had a hissy fit, and he would have been justified, quite possibly.
Oh, listen, it was nothing. You should hear what we say in private about you folks.
Well, yes, that's a very graceful way to deal with the problem.
Mm-hmm. It also happens to be true.
Yeah.
My brother refers to your commander as General Tupais.
Oh, no, that's his real hair.
It's just the way in our culture of showing profound disrespect.
When you tell an Afghan man he looks like he's wearing a toupee, he has to give you a goat, or he loses all stature in the village.
Well, that's interesting. Well, we're going to add that to our briefing books on the culture.
Good.
But again, Hamid, our profound thanks for not making a bigger thing out of this than it already was. Which, of course, it wasn't.
Yes.
Why is it when I listen to him talk, I feel like I've been mainlining my own product?
Why is it when I listen to you talk, I realize we're out of time? Thanks for the call, Mr. Gates.
I should leave before nightfall anyway. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Legal services for Cars I Talk were provided by Ketchum and Newcom.
Hawaiian-style catering for today's show provided by Tiki Leaks.
Join me and my little brother, Wally, next week for another edition of Cars I Talk.
This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
Party till the money's gone.
Party till the money's gone.
You party till the money's gone. the money's gone.
A party till the money's gone.
This is Le Show, and now it's time for me to read the trades for you. From Marketing Daily, a Q&A with the head of the Partnership for a Drug-Free America, which, on this occasion, is changing its name. Really? Yes, I'll read it for you. How else would you know? Steve Paslerb, president of CEO of the partnership, was asked to tell what's new in anti-drug marketing and how far the organization has come since This Is Your Brain, This Is Drugs, This Is Your Brain on Drugs. Question, first you ditched America in your title. Really? Why the name change? Answer, we became increasingly aware that our name was a problem. As soon as you said Partnership for a Drug-Free America, people would say something like, do you really think there will ever be a drug-free America? So you're back on your heels right away. Drug-free works. Parents either want to keep kids drug-free or if they have a kid using drugs, they want it to stop. And partnership was magic, too. The word America was the problem. So the emphasis is on reaching parents? Yes. We can give the suburban mom the kind of tools she needs to intervene, help her find the right kind of treatment, and take some of the shame and stigma away. We're becoming like, more like other disease-specific organizations. Question, how are parents of teens different from when you launched back in 1986? They are the most drug-experienced parents in history. Today, you're more likely to find the parent of an eighth grader who did drugs than an eighth grader who has. What about pot now that it's become more or less legal in so many places? These initiatives are normalizing marijuana as a part of society. Both kids and parents view it as a safe way to get high with no downside. Is that true of prescription drugs too? Yes, a kid will say, I don't smoke pot, but I take Adderall to help me get through a test and then I cop some Vicodin to calm down. It gives me a badass badge without the risk. Only a very little bit of the kid's decision has to do with getting high. Can you use marketing to scare kids away from drugs? Scare tactics can work. If you use a relevant risk message, you can't tell these kids marijuana will kill them. It won't, and they know it. You can tell them it may make them drop their tray in the cafeteria in front of a girl they like, and to a middle schooler who isn't worried about death, that's a very relevant message. From Steve Paslerb of Partnership for Drug-Free Nowhere, I guess. Partnership for drugfree.org. America was the problem. Steve, why do you hate freedom? The question occurs to me when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And ladies and gentlemen, you know that President Obama, in his news conference on Tuesday, announcing the tax cut deal, referred to the situation he found himself in vis-a-vis the Republicans in the Senate as a hostage situation. And now I'm being told we have to go to the network for a special broadcast, so we'll continue the show moments from now.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, a special report. I'm Milton Getzler at the Special Report microphone in Washington. Normally, each week at this time, CPR brings you the President's weekly internet/radio address. This week, in its place, the White House has just released the following set of remarks recorded by President Obama at an unknown location. And here's the President.
Hello. I hope you're having a good weekend. When I spoke at my press conference earlier this week about the tax cut deal being akin to a hostage situation, many of the Washington pundits thought I was being metaphorical. Well, the joke appears to be on them as well as on me. My hostage takers have asked me to make this tape to let my family, as well as my base, know that I'm fine. I'm being well taken care of. I have plenty of food. I have the newspapers, the internet, and television. I'm not able to watch the news, but I am enjoying a Mythbusters marathon. I'm speaking not only for my hostage takers, but myself, when I say that this is not a situation that calls for any kind of force being used in an attempt to free me. Already the spectacle of Bernie Sanders' filibuster has done nothing but caused my, let's call them captors, to dig in their heels. That's not only bad for the carpet, it's bad for the country. It's never a good idea to negotiate with hostage takers, of course. But that's what I decided we had to do. They responded by actually taking me hostage. This is not only unprecedented, but of course it's unpresidential. Again, it's not a situation I think should be dealt with at this time by any kind of force. Lives are at stake here, and we're not talking about Afghan civilians. Calm and patience are what are called for. That's what I bring to the table. But unfortunately, I'm nowhere near the table. So I just want to use this tape to communicate to my advisors, my cabinet, my allies, that these people are deadly serious. They are dedicated to achieving their aim of a continuation of the Bush tax cuts for people making over $250,000 a year. And they believe that we can do nothing to stop them. I have to say that even if I weren't making this tape in a hostage situation, I agree with them. So I call upon my friends in Congress to live up to a deal that admittedly they have no part in reaching. It's a good deal because it will let me spend the holidays with my loved ones instead of in this, what appears to be a best 3-star hotel. To my family, my wife and my girls, I love you and I miss you very much. Don't worry. We'll have Christmas whenever I get home. The timber lobby has already promised to send another tree. I just ask everyone to be calm, to ask themselves, what would I do, and then agree to the hostage taker's demands. It may not be the best thing to do, but it's the right thing to do. Thanks very much.
President Obama, in a remarkable set of remarks, recorded in an unknown location. Funds for this broadcast came from the Special Report Microphone Fund. I'm Milton Getzler in Washington, and this is CPR Continental Public Radio. We know what our initials stand for.
All right, and now back to the show and the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Calgary, a Toronto woman who said she felt threatened after receiving an email response from a former advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, has received an apology. Janet Raymond sent an angry email to Tom Flanagan after he mused on a talk show that President Obama should consider assassinating Julian Assange. The initial email response from the University of Calgary political science professor was short: better be careful, we know where you live. Janet Raymond said she took that as a threat and called Toronto police, who told her the threat was only borderline. She has now received a full apology. I'm sorry I did not send a more serious response to your email. Flanagan's new email reads, I regret that I made glib and thoughtless comments about a serious subject. I was never seriously proposing to do harm to Mr. Assange, he adds. The son of Pink Floyd guitarist David Gilmour has apologized for swinging from a British Union Jack on the cenotaph during the student protests in London on Thursday. Charlie Gilmour, 21 years old, said he was mortified by his moment of idiocy, that's his words, after he climbed onto the memorial to Britain's war dead in Whitehall. Gilmour, a history student at Cambridge, said he was deeply ashamed. I would like to express my deepest apologies for the terrible insult to the thousands of people who died bravely for our country that my actions represented. I feel nothing but shame. He apologized to other protesters, saying his actions had detracted from the cause the protests were trying to highlight. Oh, what's the cause? We'll get to that later. No, it's the raising of tuitions at universities. Daylight Louisville, a Kentucky man who acknowledged threatening President Obama in a poem, has been sentenced to nearly 3 years in prison. Johnny Logan Spencer apologized for writing the poem, which described a fatal sniper shooting of the president. The 28-year-old said in federal court in Louisville that he was upset over his mother's death and had fallen in with a white supremacist group that had helped him kick a drug habit. Can't beat those excuses. Popular blogging platform Tumblr said it was getting back on its feet after a database tumble that left it out of service for nearly 24 hours. New York-based startup apologized for the system crash that had it offline for about a day. It said in Twitter messages that it had a major issue in one of its database clusters. So maybe if Tumblr is using Twitter, well, you get the message. Daylight in New Orleans, Mayor Mitchell Andrews apologized to the family of Henry Glover, who was fatally shot and his body was burned in the aftermath of the flooding of the city in 2005. On Thursday, three current and former New Orleans police officers were found guilty of the victim's death. I would like to extend my personal sympathies to the Glover family and extend an apology to them. Our thoughts and prayers are with them, the mayor said. He added, what happened to Glover was a sad chapter in the city's history, vowing to make the New Orleans Police Department a force that citizens can be proud of. And a New Orleans cop who spat in the face of a fellow officer as he was being handcuffed during an arrest for drunken driving has resigned from the force and apologized. David Ogazalek has agreed to leave the force in order to avoid prison time for battery on a police officer and driving while intoxicated. Judge Robin Pittman sentenced him to 6 months in jail, suspended, and ordered him to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Ogazalek also apologized to Officer Floyd Jackson for spitting on him during the arrest. Ogazalek and Jackson shook hands and embraced at hearing's end. As a notorious former priest was sentenced to a 12-year prison term on sex abuse charges, Dublin's Archbishop Diarmid Martin apologized to victims and acknowledged that the Archdiocese of Dublin, quote, failed these children. I can only unreservedly apologize to the victims of this man for what they endured and for the way in which the diocese failed them, he added. Dayline Bucharest, Romanian public television, where there are no tote bags, apologized Thursday for broadcasting a show in which a journalist praised a pro-Hitler Romanian fascist leader as, quote, a person of integrity. In a statement, TVR said the comments had wounded the feelings of people affected by the virulent anti-Semitism and the crimes against humanity, which marked a black period in Romania's history. Romania public television. On Monday morning, Radio 4 in England, presenter James Naughty was discussing an upcoming interview with Jeremy Hunt, the culture secretary. Naughty stumbled over Hunt's name in a way that would, if you completed the sentence, have him referring to the culture secretary, if you get my drift. And tried in vain to cover the mistake with a faux coughing fit before disappearing from the airways for 20 minutes. He apologized, blaming a certain Dr. Spooner, reference to Dr. William Spooner, who was notorious for inappropriately switching letters between words. In the next hour, Andrew Marr, presenting a cultural discussion program Start the Week, had a conversation on the use of Freudian slips. He told his guests he would not repeat Naughty's earlier remarks, but did just that while trying to say Jeremy Hunt, the culture secretary. And he said, I must apologize for saying it again, but it's just very hard to talk about it without saying it. His error provoked embarrassed laughter from his guests. The BBC spokeswoman said, James and Andrew regret what happened and have both apologized for their verbal tangles on air. There are tapes of these moments on the internet. Can't play them on the radio. And Mick Hucknall, singer with the 80s star, simply read, guesses he slept with more than 3,000 women in 3 years during the band's glory years, but in an interview with a British newspaper, he's now ready to put that to bed, so to speak, and apologize for his philandering behavior. I regret the philandering. In fact, can I issue a public apology through The Guardian? They know who they are, and I'm truly sorry. When I had the fame, it went crazy. Between 85 and 87, I would sleep with about 3 women a day every day. I never said no. This is what I wanted from being with a pop, from being a pop star. My only regret is I hurt some really good girls. The only original member in Simply Red says he's retiring the band name. I don't want to be a slave to commercial success anymore. He said, I've been set free. I can do whatever I want now. He's currently the front man for the Reunited Faces. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Yes, we do know you. Ladies and gentlemen, one more item on the nuclear front. The British taxpayer will have to pick up a potentially unlimited bill for disposing of radioactive waste from Britain's new nuclear stations if costs exceed expected levels. Energy companies, including French nuclear specialist EDF, have lobbied hard to fix the level of fees they might be forced to pay for disposal. The government estimates the cap would be enough to cover 3 times the current estimated cost of waste disposal. But of course, who knows? The public will pay the rest. And an analysis of average global temperatures released Friday by NASA shows that 2010 has so far been the warmest year in its 130-year climate record. Don't tell Matt Drudge. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time with a special pre-Christmas show. Oh, my golly, how special it is. At the same time, on over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America, by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. And not digital shortwave. Yes, that's coming too. Around the world via the internet at 2 different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, on the Mighty 104 in Berlin, available on your smartphone at stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like having sex with 3 women a day, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Oh, and following up on the Canadian warning about formaldehyde in the hair straightener Brazilian blowout, the Canadians now say there's formaldehyde in 10 other kinds of hair straightener, too. So, let your freak flag fly, won't you? Or just get a FEMA trailer and your hair will straighten itself. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in Exile, and Hawaii desks. The email address for this broadcast and a playlist of the music hereon, probably still available at harryshearer.com, and you may even find a transcript of last week's interview with Eve Smith there. I'll hope that's true. A tip of the show, chapeau, in addition to Adrian Bodenham here at Global Radio in London for helping to make today's show. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. And the show is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. Now more than 20,000 followers. What are they thinking? The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica. Tom?
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Jones, Santa Monica, home of the homeless.
So long from London.